Why did intellectuals of your generation become communists?
You see, there were very different reasons. In my family, we were always left-wing bourgeoisie and always intellectuals since six generations. All the books you see have been collected from six generations since the end of the 18th century. So, and as we always never had much money, but always bought good books, you see, intelligent books. They have become very, very valuable in the last 200 years. I mean, for instance, the grandfather of my great-grandfather was an enthusiastic follower of Kant, so we have all the first editions of Kant. My great-grandfather went after he had been to prison because of political activities in 1847 to Paris and bought, of course, Heine as a contemporary.
The reason I have this question is...
1375.
I don't think
wasn't that a problem for the intellectuals, the fact that the country, until the end of the war, had been under Nazi rule, and suddenly, at the end of the war, here they were trying to establish a new society. Where did they think their support would come from? Here was a group of communist intellectuals rather isolated from
people
society.
Who became communists after the Second World War.
Yes, well, I'm thinking, isn't there a problem between people who are communists? Yes, yes.
People
like you who are communists before the war, who oppose Nazis.
Yes.
And they try to establish a new society.
Yes.
With people who sometimes were becoming communists in 1945. And wasn't that a strange problem to become a communist in 1945?
Yes, but there were not many intellectuals who became communists after 45 during the first one, two or three years. There was still much anti-Sovietism, anti-communism. And you must distinguish between those who became communists and those who decided to stay here and work somehow with the new regime. That's something very different. And of them, a number of them became, in the course of time, also communists. But they didn't start to flock to the party, let us say, in the spring of, in the summer of 1945.
Does that explain then why the regime had to be quite strong, quite tough? Because it didn't have much support in the population at that time.
Quite. You see, then came the reparations to the Soviet Union, and you can imagine how the workers reacted when the machines were taken away. And then there was this implant by Hitler. You see, when Becher, for instance, the great poet, went to Mecklenburg, which is largely countryside, in the summer of 45. He asked a peasant woman, what has surprised you most about the Russians? And he hoped, of course, that she would say something about their decent behavior. But she said, I was so surprised that they didn't have any horns. What do you say, horn, yes? Not any horns. See, that was the population.
So how did you re-educate the population, if that is the word?
Yes, that was our main task. Our main task, and we had, of course, several ways. We had the trade unions, we had the party agitators and propagandists. We had the greatest help from the Soviet cultural officers, who were wonderful men and knew our literature as, at least as well as Wille knew it. You see, they were, of course...
But wasn't there a difficulty? You yourself say that the Russians were perceived with a certain amount of distrust, how would be their influence received?
It's an enormous surprise to the intelligentsia how well the cultural officers of the Soviet Union knew our literature and our scientific work. Of course, they were selected for this purpose, but it was absolutely surprising. I'll tell you a story which may interest you. I was, in order to return as quickly as possible, I joined the American government in Germany for a few months, so I could return at once. And they had a dance with Russians and with Americans, and I was there too. And I introduced an American friend of mine who was a specialist in German literature to a Soviet officer who had also studied literature, American literature. And he told me, the American told me later on, he didn't know so very much about American literature, but he is the greatest specialist on the short story in American literature whom I have met. Interesting. Also about the kind of education. Not broad enough, but excellent as a specialist.
Now, the GDR has been concerned to present itself as the anti-Nazi state, the state that had a clean break with the Nazi path.
Quite.
However, today there is an attempt to revive Prussian history, to find some continuity with Prussian history. The rehabilitation of Frederick the Great, even new books about Bismarck, etc. Isn't there a contradiction in trying to have a clean break with the, what should one say, the darker side of the German past, and on the other hand, rehabilitating what is often perceived as a militaristic tradition?
No, I wouldn't call Frederick the Great, and I always have called him that and written about him as a great man, as the darkest side, because he was one of the, he was the only really well-educated and clever and intelligent Hohenzollern whom we had. And it is very natural that we try to understand him better than when we at first repudiated the whole of the Prussian history. On the contrary, it was high time that we started.
So why was it high time? Why was there this need to do that?
Because, you see, we must relive all the best parts, or the, at least the not bad parts of our history in order to understand the whole history of Germany and the past and the present.
But how can you do that? I mean, how do you select what is good and what is bad in Germany?
From our point of view. From our,
yeah,
of
but
course,
the point of view obviously is changing.
The point of view becomes more generous, but it's not changing, but becomes more generous.
Generous?
Yes, generous towards men who have done well and at the same time had great faults.
What do you say to people who say the GDR, in fact, is Red Prussia?
No, not at all. Not at all. Only the best parts of Prussian history.
Only the best parts. Always
yes.
Selection.
Yes, or let us say, not the worst parts.
Still, I would be interested to know what is a criterion. I mean, today, if you look at...
Humanitarian point of view.
Humanitarian?
Yes, yes, yes. And he was the most tolerant of princes of his time. Mm-hmm.
And is that the same reasoning for rehabilitating Martin Luther?
Yes, but Martin Luther was a great figure anyway. At first,
you don't have to convince me. But it's simply that everybody remembers what Marx and Engels wrote about Luther. And then one sees the great exhibition in Berlin in 1983 where Friedrich Honecker, where Mr. Honecker praised the Luther as a progressive figure, the forefather of his German socialism.
Marx wrote that Luther was an excellent economist.
An economist?
Yes, an excellent economist.
What about as a theologian?
On interest rate problems and so on. And as a theologian, he was a rebel, which also is.
But he betrayed the peasant uprising.
Yes, of course. And that's why I say we divide the...
And rule.
Yes. We divide and... Exactly, we divide and rule. Yes. Excellent. I shall remember this.
Now, talking about dividing and ruling, one is obviously thinking about the wall. Wasn't the wall an admission of failure when it was built? And the second part of my question, why is it still necessary today to have the wall?
To have the wall?
To have the wall.
Yes. Yes, you see, there was an enormous infiltration from the West, and not only ideological, this doesn't matter so much because anybody can hear the Western television, but actual penetration of disturbers and one tried to get our skilled people away, and we sent them to the universities, and then one offered them very high salaries on the other side and so on. And therefore I think the wall was necessary and still is necessary. But on the other hand, I'm very...
To keep the educated elites in the country?
I beg your pardon?
To keep the educated elites in working for socialism?
To keep them, to stop the West interfering. We can express it in this way too, both.
There is, you've mentioned yourself, the influence of the Western media, particularly West German television. What kind of problem does it pose to have a country which is where everybody can listen every evening to West German television and at the same time try to spread socialist values, educate the young people?
I don't think that there is a serious problem. Because, you see, you enjoy what you see from the West, but you have become citizens of our republic. In so many ways. I think that is an outlet, but doesn't disturb the situation in our country.
So if it's not disturbing...
1377.
Now, if you say that the penetration of the West German media in the GDR is no problem, merely a safety valve, maybe the wall has become obsolete?
Oh, no, not at all, because you see, you must distinguish between personal interference by by a person being sent to us to interrupt all kinds of things and television. That's a very great difference. You remember in 1953, when we had trouble with our workers. You had an enormous influx at once from Western Berlin by people who stirred up even more trouble. Mm.
But you as a friend of Bertolt Brecht, you remember what he said about what happened in 1953.
Yes.
If you can't change the government, perhaps you have to change the people.
Yes, but
he didn't talk about Western disturbance.
He stood 100% behind our government and wrote a letter to our government and to our party chief. You remember, he was not a member of the party, but he wrote to our party chief to say that he stood behind the government.
Even people like him acknowledge that the source of the 53 revolt was local, was indigenous. It was not something imported.
Oh, of course he said that it was important. You must not only read this one elegy which he wrote in Buko, but you must read his letters to the government and his attitude in the ensemble.
How do you explain that? And that's perhaps a more pleasant question for you. How do you explain that the GDR is the only country in Central Europe, which hasn't experienced, like Czechoslovakia, Hungary or Poland, a big upheaval, a big attempt to reform and shake up the system?
I think that we had very intelligent politicians at the head of the party and our state. And you see, today we are economically the most advanced of all socialist countries. Of course, you must exclude always the armament industry of the Soviet Union, but as far as the civil industry is concerned, and as far as economic policy is concerned, we are the best of the socialist countries. Of course, our technical level is not as high as that of the West, but we have the highest.
Does it mean you don't have to follow the Soviet example all spheres of social or economic life? What I have in mind is that in all Soviet bloc countries today, there is a great deal of talk about reform. The only country where there doesn't seem to be urgency for reform is here.
Yes. And as far as foreign policy, absolute unity. As far as economic policy, absolute unity in the strategy. And we were the first to concentrate on high tech among all the socialist countries. As far as Glasnost is concerned, we are not as far as advanced as the Soviet Union, and I'm sorry about it.
You are?
Yes,
you think
quite,
there is need for
quite, and I openly see it.
So what are the obstacles to the penetration of Glasnost in the GDR?
I think it will only a question of time and a slow process, in contrast to the Soviet Union.
And you're saying in the Soviet Union there's need for a quick process?
Yes, but you see it.
Because they are less advanced than you
yes,
are?
Yes. No, they were less advanced as we, but now they are much farther advanced as far as Glasnost is concerned than we. But of course there is not this urgent need. But on the other hand, I would be happier if we would accelerate the process of Glasnost.
But what are the internal obstacles? What do you think are the stumbling blocks? You say you would wish there were more Glasnost, but what is the main obstacle?
I don't think that there are main obstacles, but I think that there is simply a question of strategy, how quickly you should follow the Soviet example.
And do you think that East Germany could become an example for other socialist countries?
No, the Soviet Union is the example. That is no doubt. We are an example as far as economic policy is concerned, and we are an example also in certain respects as far as foreign policy is concerned. For instance, our relations with China are not only state but also party relations, and the Soviet Union has up to now only state relations with China.
One of your colleagues from the leadership of the East German Communist Party said in an interview recently that when your neighbor changes his wallpaper, you don't have to change your wallpaper too. How do you respond to this? Do you share that view? That when your neighbor
yes.
changes his wallpaper,
the,
you don't have
the
to,
what?
The wallpaper. Wallpaper. The paintings on the wall.
Oh, I see wallpaper. Yes, no. I don't agree at all with this. Not at all.
You think you should change the wallpaper?
Yes, of course we should change the wallpaper. And it isn't the wallpaper, it is much more what we should change. And we should, but, and we will change it. We will change it, but slower than in the Soviet Union.
Couldn't one even say that the speed of reform in the Soviet Union might be counterproductive for the slow, gradual pace of reform that had started in the GDR before the Gorbachev era?
Yes. In every respect, except Glasnost, we have preceded the Soviet Union. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why we are slow in following in the other respect. Because glasnost is in the Soviet Union so connected also with the economic reform and with the foreign policy reform, you see. And with us, this connection is not so necessary. But that doesn't mean that I don't hope that we shall accelerate the process of more glasnost.
Let's accelerate.
Post-Rostanist period. Yeah, okay, we don't need my question. No. Just,
1378. Okay. What is your assessment of the...
You see, I wrote a book, Dialogue with my great-grandchild. And so he asked me the same question. And I wrote about it in such a way that I said one must see the greatness of Stalin as well as the criminal acts he has committed and the faults which he has, theoretical faults, faults in theory.
But for the GDR, what did it mean concretely, the faults?
Not in the, we were quite saved from the worst sides of the Stalin period. You see, we had no capital trials and those things didn't happen with us.
Why weren't there? There were trials in the GDR, whereas there were trials in Prague. And
wonderful, Budapest. Wonderful policy of the occupational forces. I told you about them. I mean,
you really loved these occupational
forces. They were really something exceptional, and especially exceptional if you think of the Stalin period. Absolutely exceptional.
In preventing, Stalinism.
Yeah, exactly.
In its worst in not applying Stalinism. Not applying Stalinism.
No.
So what were
of course, as far as ideology is concerned, yes, but not as far as criminal acts are concerned.
So you could apply the Stalinist method of control without the criminal dimension.
Exactly. 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 And that wasn't so bad. Perhaps it was even helpful at this time when Nazism was still so rampant in the population.
So the ideal is to have the methods of control without that criminal dimension.
No, I say it's ideal, but it happened and it was very fortunate for us. But this has nothing to do with an appraisal of the Stalin time, which is very necessary and which I have started in our republic, and there is not much follow-up.
One last question, simply back to glasnost and question of reform. What would be the concrete political reforms that one would need in order for change to happen, some improvement to happen?
I don't think there is a political change necessary. And I think there is a very deliberate policy of very slowly developing glasnost.
Thank you very much.
Please.